Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I have as my guest David St. John, whose new book is from HarperCollins. It's called The Face. It's a novella in verse. And I think even the subtitle is meant to be kind of funny.
Well, to me, since it's a collection of poems, it's meant to cut both ways.
Right.
And so I'm happy you sense that.
Well, it's a strange kind of both finickiness and presumption that the poem has throughout. This is in a certain way, a loudspeaker poem in which the microphone is picking up all kinds of things usually left private. In other words, this microphone is unusually sensitive to the tones of self-pity, to self-dramatization, and to hysteria of a certain sort that's being modulated by the elegance of the line and then blown out of proportion by the length of the line, so that everything is simultaneously in perspective and out of perspective.
And I think that it's given the state of the condition of the speaker, the person who walks us through the movie of this book, since one of the conceits is that a movie is being made of his life, that the line has exactly that kind of elasticity that you're describing. In terms of the arc of the narrative, since it's a more cohesive sense of a true narrative arc, that I think it's one of the reasons why it was suggested to me that it be subtitled a novella in verse, to give it the indication right out of the box that it was something that would have this sense of narrative shape, which I'm happy to.
But at the same time, it's a movie, and at the same time a collection of poems, and at the same time he says, I don't think I'm going to continue my essay on the
cinematography of the soul.
Right.
That's right.
And we're meant, at the same time, when we hear that phrase, cinematography of the soul, I think, to simultaneously gasp and giggle, that there is a level of presumption there.
Yes. Well, it's a level of self-consciousness. It's
or narcissism.
It's an extreme self-consciousness
yeah.
that's going on. And the book in its tensions have to do with that fragmented consciousness, the sense of self-consciousness of somebody in this state of shattered wreckage trying to, in whatever way, reassemble himself and move towards some gesture of faith at some point.
Now, it was funny. In an advance note I got about the book is compared to Life Studies mm-hmm. and to Self-Portrait in
yeah.
a Convex Mirror, when to me, in its sense of rapidity, was that funny? No, that was sick. No, that was tragic. No, that mm-hmm. was awful.
Right.
It was dream songs on the one hand, and then in its sense of self-alienation, it was the story of our lives, mm-hmm. the Strand poem.
Yeah.
And I guess, in a certain sense, the impulse to find poems to compare it with is an indication that the poem wants to be original enough to need comparison in order to locate it, and at the same time, it's that awareness that it exists in a flow of bleating selves that makes it kind of ironic.
And that's why I love the Berryman suggestion, because it's that nature of fragmentation in the dream songs that we've been talking about that arises here as well. In Marx, The Story of Our Lives, in Strand's The Story of Our Lives, there's a kind of elegant opacity that the speaker has found necessary to negotiate his own sense of wreckage through this sense of... since part of the secret subject matter is, like this book, this not-so-secret subject matter is the breakup of a marriage. And so in the story of our lives, there's a sense of these watercolors running down the page with this kind of extraordinary elegance so typical of Strand. Whereas at the same time in the Berryman, there's the nervous, raucous, psychic energy in the dream songs that I'm happy, I'm really happy that you sensed here, because well, it's that sort of frisson that I really love.
It's also self-argument.
Absolutely.
And you know, and here, instead of Tambo and Bones and the dream song are parallel in a sense to them, are two female selves, Infanta and Cybele.
Right.
One of whom is playing the poet in the movie of the story of the essay of his life, and the other of whom is producing and has written or rewritten the script. Now let's begin by hearing the first section. All of these, there are three major sections of 15 poems each. The three sections amount to 45 poems. These poems are only named by their numbers, and this is the first poem in the first section in my guest David St. John's novella in verse called The Face.
I used to live there, but that was before yesterday. Yesterday is so boring, don't you think? Even my black trench coat thinks so, and it's very sophisticated, having once belonged to Dennis Hopper before I found it on the used rack at Animal House. Ron, the owner, says, fingering the shiny ink of the lapels, Dennis Hopper. Cool, I say. So into the bright day I walk out like the night. Face it, Tony says, when she sees me later at the sushi counter at Hama, Dennis Hopper, you're not. Okay, I say, but the spicy tuna's terrific today, which is why today is better than yesterday, don't you think? I said that to myself, not to Tony or Ron or anybody. I said to myself, yesterday is still so boring. When I used to live there, it was boring, and even before yesterday, it was boring. I mean, even before I knew it was boring, before yesterday. And if I still live there, I would probably think it was boring. But today, today, here with you, standing right in front of me, like the body of a shadow, or like a shadow naked as a body, like a woman dressed in a body naked as a shadow, like a shadow undressing before a mirror, like yesterday, like a mirror with a shadow and a trench coat. Well, here, today, as we both undo the loose belts of our shadows, our trench coats, our bodies, here, with you, it's really never boring. Not today, no, and not even before yesterday.
David St. John reading poem one from The Face. Now, I think in this book, this is the last time that the reader is going to feel comfortable with the tone. What I think happens here is there's a triple vision, if not quadruple, because the circumstance here, although we sense in the first poem that the character's description of his previous life and where he used to live as boring is self-defense.
Absolutely.
Eventually, the level of hysteria and terror and narcissism and protection are going to throw his tone and possibly the entire poem into a kind of ongoing question. I think it begins immediately in the second poem, so I thought we'd hear it as the transition from an already unnerved sensibility into one now entering the zone of tremor.
And this is the place as well that the figure of Infanta, the producer, the woman who wants to produce this movie. And at the end of this section, you also get a sense of the dramatic drive, even compulsion, that she has to take over in some ways. Section 2. Where was I in the world? I'm not so certain anymore. Assembling and dissembling. The pain of circumstance, broken always by one's own reflections, inscriptions of the you. Think about it long enough, and you really start to seem like somebody, really anybody. Maybe that's who I've been all along, just this restless anybody, assembling the reflections along the windows of drugstores, dress shops, fruit sellers, hairstylists, stationery specialists, and health food supplement wizards on Main Street. No, it really is called Main Street. Walking, as I always walk, with all of the beautiful and the bored, all of us waiting for our cell phones to ring with that new identity, any new identity, offered us by editors, family friends, lovers, or even our lovers' lovers, fated enemies, former companions, now in exile in Connecticut, or really anybody who sees right through the somebody we are. So I always hate those calls from anybody who tries to tell me something about the somebody I might be or should be or could be in the new movie they're making about the story of my life, or the new version of the old movie of my life, the one I was so good in acting as myself, so good, in fact, that nobody really knew I was acting. Of course, I say modestly, anybody, really anybody, could have played that role. Still, Infanta, the producer, calls to say, this is the chance of a lifetime. Don't pass up this part. This movie I'm making, starring you and, well, starring me too, who knows you better than anybody, if anybody knows anybody, though of course I do, I mean, know you. So in this movie I'm making, there's nobody but us. It's an us against the world kind of movie, and I know from all your old work it's just the part you're made for, and not just anybody could do it. So I'm telling you, it's a killer role. In fact, I can say right now that I'd stake my life on it, but so would, well, I mean, so would anybody. Sweetheart, this is the role you've always dreamt of and were always meant to play.
David St. John reading the second poem in his new novella in verse, The Face, published by HarperCollins. You're listening to Bookworm, and I'm Michael Silverblatt. Now, in that section, in the second line, as a fragment, the phrase assembling and dissembling appears, and eventually it's going to recur in the next several poems until we're sick of it.
Absolutely.
And it seems intentionally so.
It's obsessively so.
Right. And it seems also to call back visions and revisions, which a moment will erase, establishing this as a different kind of Prufrock figure, you know, devoid of love, you know, and making the noises of resonance, that kind of horror where poetry has gone beyond you to ridicule you.
A lot of what you're describing is the progress and the process of the first section, where in this sense of extreme fragmentation, the sense of the wreckage, the shattering, the speaker's trying quite literally to dissemble the meaning of what this is, as well as reassembling all of the shards of self into something with some that we might recognize as having a human shape. For a lot of this first section, I think he doesn't seem to feel that there's much human shape recognizable as he moves through the world in this way. And it's the what you're describing, I would describe less as overblown and more as a performative extravagance. It's a kind of drag show of himself, basically.
Except I think that what makes it interesting, to be honest with you, mm-hmm. is the sense of a teetering tone.
Yeah.
Not of the control. The drag artist wants to be in control. This is a drag artist who may be teetering on the high heels, who may be losing the lip sync. And what's fun in this poem, as you read it, is the sense something is going wrong.
That it's precarious.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that
beyond
this,
precarious.
Yeah.
That something has gone wrong, misfired, that tone
Absolutely.
Cannot be reacquired in some way.
And that's the sense of that wreckage, Michael. And especially in, you know, the Edge World section, where the speaker has fallen off the edge. I mean, he's quite literally made that descent.
I wanted finally to talk about the final section.
Sure.
And to give the example of the final poem, because I think something really remarkable happens there, which is that there's a vision of nothingness, which is also a vision of incipient presence. So the problem of this poem, that it seems about to affirm the abyss, becomes tossed in a way away because the emptiness is also the arrival or almost arrival of a face, and there is some tenderness or some kind of relief at finding the universe peopled in some way. So I think this is the thing that this kind of poem is challenged to do, frequently fails to do, and in a certain way, if it can't do it, you have to throw the whole sequence away.
Exactly.
Because, you know, if you can't transcend the bitterness and the agony of it, it's almost as if, you know, you've lost the battle.
Well, then it just becomes scraps of notation along the way and kinds of high-level diary entries. And unless there's that gesture of recuperation, unless there's that gesture, one could even say, of redemption or the sense of the possibility, then in some ways, what's the point of the journey? And as you know, the force of the journey through the book has been the speaker looking toward the poet seeking some affirmation, some kind of faith. And I know we've talked about this before, but in the poem No Heaven from that book of mine, something similar happens there, where there's this gesture, these gestures of affirmation that come at the end, that there's both the recognition of certain qualities of despair. But in the course of this book, the speaker discovers the figure here really discovers aspects of faith, aspects of love that begin to configure for him what ends up being this face, this figured face, that's whether it's the face of faith, whether it's the face of God, whether it's the face of nothingness, all resonate for him in this way that I hope it does what you're describing.
Here it is. It's the 45th poem in this 45-poem book, The Face. David St. John reading the final poem in The Face.
And this begins at the premiere of the movie of the speaker's life that's been made during the course of the book. I couldn't take it. 20 minutes into the first reel, I'd had it. I'd even made it down the red carpet outside Man's Chinese, the roped-off tourists craning to see if I was anybody. I'd made it through the storm of Infanta's air kisses and Sabelle's arsenal of glares. I'd made it through the week of pre-premiere talk shows and interviews. I'd made it to my hand-picked seat at the very back of the theater. Then, 20 minutes into the vertigo of the reality of it all, I felt that seasick, gravity loss, head minced, stomach kicked, full frontal nausea that would make Camus proud, and I knew I had to hurl. I don't remember getting up and slipping out. I don't remember stepping into the empty bathroom or even kicking open the stall door, just suddenly knifing over, bent double and losing it, my IV lunch and what little I had left of dignity or pride. Here I was, the subject in absentia, missing the story of my life. I have to admit, Sibelle was really great as me, at least in the little that I saw. She looked exactly like me at 18, sitting there looking up at the camera in the fields near the cemetery at Academy, California. And in those flash forwards, she was, well, superb, especially in the one where I'm with Vivian at 4, in Paris, that spring we lived on Rue de Grenelle, right off Rue de Bach. But finally, in the scenes where I'm leaving Fresno for Iowa City, the barrel of the kaleidoscope at last collapsed, and all the endless pieces of lit detail, lit syllable, and lit memory began melting together in the searing, projectionist beam as the images swirled and smeared themselves across the screen. So there I was, the hard, icy rim of the toilet carving a red moon into my forehead. Finally, I got up. Yet, instead of going back into the theater, I simply walked out into the night, slowly walking alone along Hollywood Boulevard, trying to catch my breath, trying to be able to take even one deep breath without gagging. I don't know how long I walked or really where I was, but I'd come to what looked like Hollywood's own run-down backlot. Old office buildings and warehouses, still unrenovated, unreconstructed, still awaiting their facelifts. A set, so desolate and derelict that it was almost silent there in the middle of the city. A few sirens in the distance, a woman screaming at a man, almost silent. Just those dozen or so blocks from the premiere. And I can see that the 7 Klig lights they'd trucked in front of the theater are still lifted up and crisscrossing the sky, slowly scouring the sky like those searchlights beaconing the slate night in an old World War II movie, the enemy bombers above, the dutiful London citizens below, donning their gas masks and going underground to wait out the next wave of the Blitz. I just stand there, watching, and I notice a few stray clouds have begun to pass over, a few gathering wisps quietly assembling. And it's then I realize those white batons of light all seem to have stilled, having crossed and frozen at an open space of sky where the clouds are collecting, as if each soft finger were amazed to touch, up in that black mirror of night, the simple expression of the beyond, of belief. That is, even as I watch, I believe those fragments and aspects of cloud have begun to swirl and gather in their fluid fashion into a shape that is, even in its shifting, coalescing of liquid bones, the white mask of a face, a wispy skull at first, then fleshed, it seems, by more and more accruing clouds, until the puffed lips purse with starlight and the deep sockets grow pupilled by yet even deeper apertures of black. And the Klieg lights themselves remain fixed and transfixed, the face gathering itself along the sky, no longer indeterminate, now present yet also still ephemeral, sketched by the chalky winds across the mercy of the night. It is the face I have been awaiting, the face I've been certain could reflect both the nothingness and the faith, the face I know and have always known, the face I recognize as the mirror of emptiness by which we will know the face we might one day wear, might one day lift like a mask of grace, which is the silence of the mind and the unfolding of the heart, the face of vision and the sweet delight. It was then, I think, I faded and passed out. When I awoke, the sky was blank again. Dew was gathering along my cheeks and lips. In my jacket pocket, urgent against my chest, the relentless vibrating buzz of my cell phone pulsing and pulsing over and over and over, the insistence of a heartbeat long after the body has grown distant and cold. I raise myself to one elbow to look around. I can't remember where I am or where I'm meant to be. All I know is this simple, final fact. I believe you are calling me.
David St. John reading the final poem in The Face, his novella in verse, published by HarperCollins. I don't think there's anything that can be said after hearing that poem, and so I just want to thank you for coming and talking to us about the whole arc of the piece. Thank you.
Michael, it's always a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I've been talking with David St. John, author most recently of The Face. You can read an excerpt from The Face on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now with the book of the mouse.